Hello and good morning to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and today we are officially kicking off, kicking off our live show program. This is going to be kind of interesting. You won't have the music, the intro, and all that stuff anymore that we have for the recorded ones. But we decided to go ahead and start doing some of these live just in case anybody was going to want to ask questions while we were doing it. It saves a little bit of time for me personally, if I can answer your questions, on here and talk with you and whatnot. You can send me a little message back and forth, and we'll, kind of learn this roadmap together as we're recording and answering questions and things of this nature. But a happy new year to everybody. Glad to see that we have finally started off 2021, and we're starting it off in a good way this morning by looking at the Word of God. So, we've seen throughout the book of Genesis this progression of mankind, right? We've seen that God's created the world. We've talked about how age was built into the world. We considered some of the different thoughts and ideas about these verses and pinpointed down and pegged really what the Bible's intended message was in regards to all of these different theories and things that are going on. And then to follow that up, of course, we have seen mankind come into existence. We've seen the fall of mankind. We've seen the first people that are born. We've seen two different lines of individuals on the earth. We've seen the ungodly line of Cain and, of course, the godly line of Seth. We had that really tough discussion for everybody with Genesis chapter 6. Earlier this week of, okay, well, what's this talking about? What's this really getting at? And I gave you my thoughts and my reasoning and decisions in regards to what really is going on in chapter 6 and what leads to eventually God feeling that he needs to destroy the entire world and start over. And of course, we know that the reasoning behind why God has, you know, quote unquote, decided to automatically reset button the earth is because even the righteous men at this point had begun to intermingle with lost and unrighteous people. And sadly, the reality is that when we begin to join ourselves to people that are lost, when we begin to join ourselves, especially in a marital sense, especially, you know, since that's what's going on in chapter 6, is we have a marital sense, or at least a sexual sense for certain, in that they have children together. But when we enter into those bonds, we've tied ourselves that way physically to a lost individual. The likelihood of us changing that individual to meet, you know, to follow God and to decide to want to do the things of God is a lot less likely than us turning over to their sinful ways and chasing after the same behavior that they have already been living and, of course, demonstrating in their life. Now, that's not because evil overpowers good or because the Bible can't change anybody or anything of that nature. I think there is obviously a huge argument from Paul's perspective of, if a person gets saved who is already married to a lost individual, that that is their mission field. But the Bible does take the time to explicitly state in multiple places that if we are a saved individual, we should not be looking to marry someone who is lost for this very reason. 9 times out of 10, the flesh is going to overpower, is going to rule over, take precedent over the things of God. And so what happens here is we have all this intermingling to a point that eventually we have these children that are mighty men of renown. We talked about the fact that it's kind of funny to me that everybody says that there's these giants that are the offspring of this line of this sons of God and daughters of men situation, but it never at all says that that's what the offspring are, but rather that they become mighty men of renown. which means great warriors. great warriors, not in a character sense, like they're good guys, but that they were strong fighters. They enjoyed killing people. They enjoyed doing things that they ought not to do, that they shouldn't have ever considered doing in the first place. And they develop a reputation for what they, for their lifestyle and the things that they decide they want to go about. And this intermingling gets to a point that when God looks at the earth, there is but one individual. Doesn't say Noah's family, doesn't say Noah and his wife. It says one individual, Noah, was the only man that God saw that was even attempting to follow him, was attempting to live a righteous life. And because of that, he finds grace in the eyes of God, meaning that God chooses to bestow grace upon Noah. I think there's all too often that we try to turn Noah into a great stronghold figure for God, but I would hesitate to say that. He had the faith to do what God wanted to do, and he had the obedience, certainly, yes. But we know that from some of his actions and behaviors and the actions and behaviors of his sons after the flood, that he wasn't exactly a powerhouse for God as far as character and righteous living goes. No, nowhere near like his grandfather Enoch, okay? But he is doing what he can. He's living as righteous of a life as he can attempt to live. And he is obedient to God, and therefore God calls him and tells him what he needs to do in preparation for this flood, okay? Tells him to build the ark, how to do it, and it says, and Noah did all that according to what God commanded him, so did he. That's the end of Genesis chapter 6. Then there's 100 years of time that passes between Genesis chapter 6 and Genesis chapter 7. Because what happens is that the next verse we see is God commanding them to come into the ark and to bring the animals into the ark. So 100 years passes between chapter 6, chapter 7. During that time, I can only imagine what it was like. Okay, you have people that would have definitely been mocking Noah, assuming Noah didn't already kind of live out in the boonies. You definitely would have had people that thought Noah was crazy. He's talking about floods and rain, a concept that nobody has seen, nobody understands, nobody knows anything about. You can't have a flood without, water coming from a place that it shouldn't have already been. So all of these things that Noah would have been preaching for the last 100 years while building the ark, it just sounded like absolute foolishness, I'm sure, to the entire world. And I'm sure that he was made fun of quite a bit for doing something as crazy as building a boat in the middle of the desert. So here he sits for this 100 years. He's building and doing all of these things. And while he is building and going about doing all of this, he's preaching the message that by the time he's done building, the world is going to flood and everyone who is not on that boat is going to die. And nobody listens. Nobody hears the words of Noah. They don't pay any attention to it. In fact, there's so little attention given to it that we don't even read the reaction of the world inside these chapters. There's no, the people gathered at the boat after it's closed, it starts to rain, and they go, no, let us in, or, anything of this nature. That they are completely and totally just removed from it. They're not listening to any of it. They don't want anything to do with any of it. They're not going to hear any of it. And so what we have here is 100 years that leads up to this moment beginning in chapter 7. So and the Lord said unto Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation. Now, right off the bat, this is a very interesting verse. It's a verse that's not reflected on a whole lot. I really don't know why it's not discussed more deeply and more profoundly. Because what happens here is that Noah has built this ark, right? He's built this boat. He is, you know, he's carried out, done all the work. And if you and I did this kind of work, okay? If you and me went out and we built a shed, okay? We get all the tools. We cut all the wood. We lay the foundation. We put in the wood. We put in the trusses and the roof. And then we put in the insulation and the drywall and all this nonsense. And maybe it's a metal building on the outside. We're going to get fancy, okay? By the time we're done with this, all right? By the time we're done, we've got this shed. Whose shed is it in our mind? Well, it's ours, right? If I built it with you, then there's a part ownership in it, unless, of course, you paid me or I paid you, okay? The point, though, is that in our mind, it is our possession. We put in the time, we put in the work, we put in the money, the materials, all of these things. It is ours. But notice what God says to Noah. Come thou and all thy house into the ark. This is an invitation from God. This wasn't go into the ark that you've built. Go in it. That God does not give Noah ownership over this vessel in any way, shape, or form. Even though Noah's built it, even though Noah and his family have done all of this, the lesson here is that this salvation, this opportunity to live when all the rest of the world is going to die, was not owned by Noah. It was not earned by Noah. It was not in any way, shape, or form had anything to do with Noah or who he was as a man. He is invited to this opportunity for his life and his family to be saved from the destruction of the world. Something that is placated throughout the entire Bible from beginning to end is that you and I do not earn salvation. We cannot earn it. There's no way that we can get into heaven on our own accord. There's no way that we could preserve ourselves on our own accord. There's no way we could go through this life on our own accord. It is all by God's invitation, by God's grace, and by God's mercy. So even though Noah put in all this work, time, and effort, it didn't matter because the only way Noah was going to get on that ark and his family be rescued was if the gift was extended to him freely by God. Already in Genesis chapter 7, and this may hurt some feelings, but already in Genesis chapter 7, the ideology of being able to work for one's salvation is thrown all the way down the drain. Noah did all the work, did all the time, built the whole thing. But he still wouldn't have got on that boat if God didn't invite him and allow him to do so. If not for the grace of God, Noah and his family would have died just like all the rest. And so after all this time, after all this building, God invites them onto the ark. And I love it because he says, "For thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation." So not only is God expressing this invitation for them to be saved, but the reason he's expressing this invitation for them to be saved is because they believed and they did what God told them to do. Again, not because of something that they had ability to accomplish on their own. God came, God gave the message, they accepted it, and it's because of that that they are being invited to come into the boat. They're being invited to be saved. He says, "Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of the beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female, of fowls also of the air by sevens, the male and female, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. For yet 7 days I will cause it to rain upon the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth." All right. So God tells them, invites them to come into the ark, right? And after he has invited them to, he gives a very interesting command. You shall take with you seven each of every clean animal, right? And two of each of animals that are unclean. Now, this is very, very interesting because you are always told that there was what? Two of every animal, right? Male and female that went into the boat. But what is these verses telling you? Of every clean animal, you will take seven each. A male and his female. Two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also, seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. That's how we would break this down into modern language. So, how many animals are actually going on the ark at one particular group of time? Well, it's not just boy and a girl of this one. For the clean, there were seven that were taken on the ark. And some say that this means seven pairs, some mean seven individual animals. Doesn't matter either way. I would say it's probably more likely that it's seven pairs just because he says seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female. Okay? Meaning boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. But either way, two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female, could be two pairs or just mean two animals. Either way, it's not what you typically see if you like went to the play in Branson where they're like boy giraffe, girl giraffe, boy chicken, boy goat, girl goat. Depending on whether or not this animal was deemed clean, which is a concept that's starting to be introduced already in Genesis, huh? Is depended how many were actually brought onto the ark. More clean animals were brought than unclean. Now, is that because all of these animals had different levels of varying righteousness? No. Is it because these animals had this decision to make, some of them are better than others? No, we know from the New Testament that the discussion about these animals was to teach obedience. It was to teach a lesson about how we are supposed to view spiritual versus carnal things. It was a command that we were to try in every way, shape, or form, understand this idea of purity versus sinfulness. And so what we're seeing here in these verses is not that there's some animals that are better than others, but again, that lesson that the righteousness of God is more important. Cleanliness and purity before God is more important. What has gotten the world into the situation that it's currently in? Well, what's gotten the world into the current situation that it's in is that there is no desire for there to be any sort of godliness in this world. And so we see that they're bring on these different amount of animals, and of course, God also gives the commandment of what's going to happen. He says, "For yet 7 days, and I will cause it to rain upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And every living substance that I have made will I destroy from off the face of the earth." And Noah did according unto all that the Lord commanded him. And Noah was 600 years old when the flood of the waters was upon the earth. And Noah went in, and his sons, and his wife, and his sons' wives with him into the ark because of the waters of the flood. Of clean beasts, and of beasts that are not clean, and of fowls, and of everything that creepeth upon the earth, there went in two and two unto Noah into the ark, the male and the female, as God had commanded Noah. So, the beasts, of course, go in two by two. Everybody knows that. You go boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, as we're going into the ark. Noah's 600 years old by this point. 100 years have passed. God tells Noah, you're going to load everybody up. You're all going to get in. You're going to sit for 7 days. Another thing that's left out. Noah sits on the ark for 7 days. No rain, no flood. As everybody's getting comfortable, getting things prepared, God's going to seal them in the ark, of course. But they're on the boat for 7 days. No rain, no flood. That's their time to get prepared. Their time to get everything into position, for lack of a better way of putting it. And after that, all of this has happened, how many days and nights is it going to rain? 40, right? Everybody, oh yeah, 40 days, 40 nights. And then we kind of tend to forget that he's in there for another 150 days after the rain and all that is done. But so Noah, at the ripe old age of 600 years old, gets the ark built. He's invited into it by God. The animals that God wants saved and how he wants them saved, all this work God did for Noah. There's no way Noah could have went and got all these animals. God brings these animals to Noah. Once they arrive, God tells Noah, you're going to have 7 days to have everybody get on the boat, get everybody prepared, get all the animals on board, and so everybody is loaded up. And then it says, and it came to pass after 7 days, 1 week of sitting, that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. There's kind of a funny story that I always heard as a kid growing up, that people would try to piece together what it was like. You know, they said, oh, and it started raining. God sealed the boat. You know, everybody was like, huh, this is kind of weird. And then, you know, it got about an inch and then 2 inches and 3 inches. Yeah, I'm sure you've heard this, people making this joke. You know, they had to get the rain boots out and then they started getting nervous when it got up to their neck. This kind of nonsense. That is not at all how this happened. 7 days after Noah is given these 7 days to prepare, the end of those 7 days, the fountains of the great deep were broken up and the windows of heaven were open. The idea is it was instantaneous. They were on the boat. Everybody was loaded up. They're ready to go. And of course, we're going to see here in just a moment where it says that God, you know, commanded all of them to get in. It kind of gives you a summary of what has already been told to be done in the beginning part of this chapter, and that God seals them in. But what happens is that we're telling you, okay, this is the exact day that all this happened. 7 days passed. This is how old Noah was. How many months in? How many days in? It's the second month of his life, 7th day of the month. Okay? Immediately, all the fountains of the great deep are broken up, meaning all those underwater reservoirs that are inside the earth immediately gush to the surface. As the same time as that's happening, God opens the heaven, which is this firmament that we talked about. We talked about the fact that the reality of what is meant here of the firmament in chapter 1 is this condensing, cooling, insulating layer of water around the earth that would have created a perfect atmosphere. All of that water vapor that we now see in vast amounts, of course, via the ocean and rivers and all these things, is immediately allowed to fall to earth. So as we have trillions and trillions of gallons of water above us, and we have trillions and trillions of gallons of water beneath us, and they are unveiled all at the same time, there wouldn't have been any gradual increase in water. The 40 days and 40 nights is not because it was going to take God 40 days and 40 nights to flood the whole world. The 40 days and 40 nights is the symbol of trial and is God making sure that he gets the job done right the first time. So not only do we have this immediate rupturing, but then, of course, it says, and the rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. We have an immediate flooding that would have covered a great amount of the earth, but to fully cover the earth entirely, it rains for another 40 days and 40 nights. It says, in the self same day. Okay, so we have, this is what happened on this day. However, we're going to back the story up just a little bit. Something you're going to learn about Hebrews is that they have a very weird a tactic about them, where they like to say something and then back it up and go, hey, let's talk about this though. So we see that 7 days have passed. It's starting to rain. Things are happening. The firmament has dropped. We have the earth that has ruptured. The world is beginning to flood. And for 40 days after this, it's raining, 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 raining. Then, it says in the selfsame day, so we're going to back up to right before all that happened. Entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his sons with them into the ark. So in the selfsame day, Noah and his family begin to load themselves on. Everything is locked up. All the animals are on board. It says, they and every beast after his kind, and all the cattle after their kind, and every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth after his kind, and every fowl after his kind, every bird of every sort. And they went in unto Noah into the ark, two and two of all flesh, wherein his is the breath of life. And they that went in male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him. And the Lord's in unto Noah into the ark, two and two of all flesh, wherein is the breath of life. Sorry, I'm going to back up and say that again. And they that went in male and female of all flesh, as God had commanded him, and the Lord shut him in. So, says we're going to back up. This is what happened on this day. However, earlier, Noah and his family have been loaded onto the ark. Everybody is in place. All of the animals are in place. And what is awesome about this passage is that it's not Noah that gets all of this finalized. It's not Noah that completes this work. It's the fact that God shut him in. What's amazing about the picture of Noah's ark, literally, is not even the fact that there's this ginormous boat. It's not the fact that the world is completely destroyed. It's really not even the fact that there's a whole bunch of animals that just migrate their way to Noah's boat and he gets everybody loaded in. What's amazing about the story of Noah's ark is that it is by and all forms and fashions a very strong symbolic placement of what salvation is and how salvation works. We see that in the beginning of chapter 7, Noah's family is invited in. It wasn't something that Noah earned. It wasn't something that Noah worked for. It wasn't something that God said, okay, Noah, you and your family are going to be saved because you built this boat. Even after all of these things, we saw from chapter 6, it's because God bestowed grace upon Noah. But not only because he bestowed grace upon Noah, but he invited Noah. Come thou and all thy house into the ark. It is so important that we understand that God calls men to salvation. He calls all men to salvation. It's not something that we can earn. It's not something that we can try to achieve on our own accord. It is a gracious gift that's freely given by God. And not only after he invites him in, does he leave him, okay, well, now you got to figure out the rest. He finalizes and seals it and does it himself, shuts it in. But what's also beautiful about this on the flip side, not for Noah, but for the lost world that was around Noah's ark, is that God waited until the very last moment to shut that door. Up until that point, friend, they had had 100 years watching this crazy old guy out there building a boat with his family, preaching, I have no doubt in my mind, what was going to come to pass, what was going to happen when this boat was completed. And up until the very last day, the day when all this was going to go down, that door was open for anybody who wanted to get their act together and come into it and enjoy the safety and the love of God. The problem was that we know from chapter 6, the world had gotten to a point it was so evil that they had no desire to do it. They had no desire to serve God. They had no desire to want to reach a point of restoration with God. And so we see out of all the people in the world, and we talked earlier in the podcast before we started this live show with everybody too, to kind of help level out some of the questions that I was getting, and being able to answer them live instead of typing papers to some of you later on after we had listened to the recordings. We know that there was a very good chance that there was 4 to 5 million people by this time on the earth. Some even speculate more than that based off the length of Adam's life. Okay? So you have out of all these people on the planet, there's but one family that wants to accept the love of God and get on this boat. I can only imagine how God would have felt to be a look around the entire world, not 1500 years after we are into the humanity story, the humanity's timeline with the fall of man, and see but one family that still desired to walk with God. And yet still had the patience and the love to wait this long before shutting the door on a world that was so evil, God said, we're going to have to reset this. There is no greater story, I would say, in the Old Testament beyond what God prophesies in chapter 3 when men fall about a coming Messiah than the story of Noah's Ark, where you see a world that's so evil, yet God still gives this opportunity. God still is providing this opportunity for them to come to Him, to get their act together, to learn better, to know better. It's beyond amazing to see what God does even here of providing this opportunity. And so, of course, it says that He shut him in, and the flood was 40 days upon the earth, and the waters increased and bare up the ark, and it was lift up above the earth. And the waters prevailed and were increased greatly upon the earth. And the ark went upon the face of the waters, and the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. And all flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast and of every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. All in whose nostrils was the breath of life of all that was in the dry land died, and every living substance was destroyed which was upon the face of the ground, both man and cattle and the creeping things and the fowl of the heaven, and they were destroyed from the earth. And Noah only remained alive, and they that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Okay, so one of the biggest things you're going to get as a child of God when you talk about the story of Noah's Ark is you're going to get about three different theories about how this worked. Okay, number one, you're going to get some people that believe, well, it was only a local flood. Okay, the idea, the concept of a worldwide flood sounds too outside of human logic for these individuals. Okay. They say, well, it was a local flood. Well, we have a problem with that. How many of you have ever seen a local flood that covers the mountains? Hey, you never have, right? There's no way in the world. If we actually leveled out, okay, we're going to cover this one mountain, we'd have to put a mountain 150 feet below sea level before we could actually cover the mountain. So there's no way this could have been just a local flood, right? The second one you're going to get is that there's no flood at all. This is all myth. This is all made up. Never happened. Okay? And then the third one you're going to get is what obviously anybody who says they believe in the Bible believes, and that is that this was a worldwide flood. Okay? The entire world was covered in water. Now, there is a couple of things here that we can discuss and that we can answer about this. First of all, local flood, that concept is very easily dismayed and thrown out the window. And the reason for that is because you would basically have to have a fishbowl in the middle of the world for this amount of flooding to happen, yet not flood the entire world all at the same time. Okay? Now, because that one's very easily dismissed, would this discussion of no flood ever happen? If you talk to lost people, deal with lost people, or even in some cases, sadly enough, deal with higher critics of the scriptures and higher criticism of the scriptures. There's many people that argue this could have never possibly happened. They know it's in the Bible, but they don't think it belongs there, which in itself, I don't know why you would believe in a Bible if you can go through it and but also believe that parts of it are made up fairy tales and we need to remove that. I feel like that takes away from the credibility of the Bible quite a bit. You might be a fool for believing in it if you already think there's something wrong with it. But that's a totally different discussion for another time. The reason that I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that there was a flood is from a multiplicity of reasons. Okay, first of all, there is scientific fact, factual basis, that this indeed happened. Now, they're not going to tell you that it happened the way that we know it happened according to the Bible, but it did happen, and they know that it happened, and that the world was indeed underwater completely at one point. A lot of reasons for this. I used to do a lot of fossil hunting back in my younger days. You can find ocean life on top of mountains. I did some fossil hunting out in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Went out for about 2 weeks to do some looking for crinoids, and blastoids, these kinds of things. Ammonites, too. New Mexico is known for having quite a few ammonites. One of the biggest ammonites I ever found was on a mountain way, way up in the northern part of the Santa Fe Hills. He didn't get up there by getting out of the water and walking to the top of that hill, ladies and gentlemen. He was up there because that mountain was at one point underwater. And of course, there's this discussion of tectonic plates pushing up mountains and these things. And guys, I can promise you right now that the likelihood of the tectonic plate moving a mountain right in the middle of a landmass and pushing this ammonite up, that you're really grasping at straws there. But so firstly, scientific fact, fossils are found all the time on tops of mountains that are ocean-based, and there are many scientists that back up the fact that at one point the world was completely underwater. Secondly, there is a massive cultural and historical basis for a flood happening. There are literally hundreds of cultures that have a flood story, okay? Now, a lot of argumentation that is made with that is that some of these, according to history and carbon dating and all these things, happened long before the writing of the Hebrew flood narrative, okay? That may be the case, but it's also true of the fact that God did not begin putting together his nation and his Bible until long, long after the flood would have happened. So it would make sense that other cultures and people that it began to exist after the flood would have already begun to write down these kinds of things. Just because a narrative was historically written prior to another group writing it does not dissuade what is true or what is factual. And what is awesome about this is when you go doing a little digging into it, because a lot of people, oh no, there's no way a worldwide flood ever happened. There is literally over 200 cultures that have their own account of the flood. Now, what's very cool about this is that 88% of these cultures have what we refer to as a favored family, meaning that there is some individual group of people that are favored, that are maintained to be kept alive. Okay, 70% of those attribute that survival to a boat. 95% say the sole cause of that catastrophe is, of course, a flood. Okay. 66% of them say that that disaster is due to the evil of man. All right. 67% record that animals are also brought on and are saved. And 57% describe the survivors end up on a mountain. And even more amazing to that is that many of them also specifically mention birds being sent out to see if the floodwaters had receded, a rainbow, and literally 8 people being saved. So right off the bat, for anybody that says a flood of any kind did not happen, that is 110% false. A worldwide flood did happen. Now, you may not believe it the way that I do, and you may argue with me about it the way that I do, But to try to completely say, no, a worldwide flood never occurred does not work in any way, shape, or form. You don't have 200 cultures with that much similarity in stories unless, indeed, this did at one point happen. Even today, humanity, when we talk about this or that, we may not completely agree on history. I promise you, America doesn't teach World War II the way Europe or Russia or any of these other countries teach World War II. However, we all could agree on a massive basis that World War II did indeed occur. Meaning there may be variations in stories, variations in perspectives, but if you have over 200 cultures historically dating almost 4,000 years back to now, who all agree a flood happened, then what had to have happened? The flood. Now, I believe, without 110% of doubt in my mind, that it happened according to what's going on here. The wickedness of man had rose to a point that God was looking for an opportunity to save the redemptive plan of man, and he found that in Noah. So, if there's anybody that argues with you about a flood happening, there is overwhelming evidence, without ever touching the Bible, that a worldwide flood did occur and that it occurred on a massive scale, historically, culturally, scientifically. So we have Noah and his family. The door is sealed. The world is immediately flooded. We have water coming from the air, trillions and trillions of gallons of water from outside of this firmament. We talked about that in our earlier recordings with Genesis chapter 1 and what a perfect environment would have looked like, a perfect atmosphere, these kinds of things. And then we have trillions and trillions of gallons of water coming from under the earth, you know, the wells of the deep that open up. World is flooded. To maintain that flooding, raising it to the level that it was, we have rain for 40 days and 40 nights. After all of that rain, though, we still have 150 days that there is water on the earth. So it rains for 40 days and 40 nights, and then Noah and his family spend an additional 150 days on the ark. So over an entire period, we have almost a year's time that passes before we have earth come back, and then we get into what we're going to get into next week with Noah's life. It's a very amazing thing. And of course, it proves further that this wasn't a local flood, but rather a worldwide flood. It takes 150 days for all the water to recede, to be gone, to get into the ground. It's an amazing, amazing story, not only from everything that occurs, but what I want you to take away heavily from chapter 7 as we're getting ready to close off today and let you go about enjoying your new year. Is that this is indeed a beautiful picture of how salvation works for mankind, and the fact that even from the beginning, God was already looking for a way to redeem man, despite the fact that we didn't deserve redemption. We made our decision in the garden. We made our decision to be a disobedient. We made our decision to go against God and to sin against God and to thought that we knew better than God. Yet despite the fact that we went about all of those things on our own accord, despite the fact that we chose to put ourselves in the sinful condition that we were in, and even despite the fact that by this point mankind has gotten so evil, there is but one family who God finds to be able to bestow upon grace, because the idea of being worthy or earned is not even given there. It says that Noah found grace, meaning that God literally chose to bestow his grace upon Noah. And yet God still desires to save the world is absolutely amazing. It's an absolutely amazing story of not only the love of God, but the desire of God for the redemptive plan of man to be brought into fruition, no matter what that cost was to himself personally or what it required of him to do. Well, with all that said, that is Genesis chapter 7. I hope all of you have had a great Christmas so far. I know I've gotten to talk to a few of you since then. And I hope all of you have a great new year as well today. A little rainy and nasty where I am, but I hope the rest of you have the opportunity to get out and enjoy it. Make sure to go back, read over chapter 7. Go back, read through chapter 1 to chapter 7. Refresh yourself on what we've talked about. We have talked about a lot of stuff in regards to this. Genesis is a very loaded book of the Bible. And so make sure to go back and kind of look over that. If you're new and joining us on here today and that you're new, we're glad to have you here with us today. Hope you have enjoyed this podcast as well. You can go back to, for those of you that are new, we did an overview, kind of an Old Testament, New Testament survey of all the books of the Bible before we started going book by book, chapter by chapter, verse by verse, through the Word of God. That you can go back and kind of get a little bit of grips on there. There's a little bit more history and culture that's discussed in those and get brought up to date with us. But as always, this has been Studies to the Bible.